Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. So here we are on the waxing full moon. It's the full moon in Cancer Capricorn, which is about teasing concern for life into actual collective governance. There we go. It'll be Sunday morning there. But so more than perfectly, this is our enthuso anarcho woofing with Charles Allison, biographer of Ukrainian anarchist leader Nestor Makhno. Oh, I'm so grateful that we tease the dedicated vision and myriad befoiblements of the anarchist revolution into guiding pertinence with special honoring of Kropotkin and mutual aid in resonating relevance. So Charlie Allison is a writer, researcher, storyteller based in Philadelphia. He's worked as a gardener, tutor to children with learning disabilities, an English teacher, a chess instructor, and as a bureaucrat. Yes, it's good to explore all the realms of hell. He has published short stories in Bickman's Press, Podcastle, and Sea Lion Press. He's active in Philadelphia storytelling and mutual aid communities. Oh, how wonderful. Charlie is frequently bullied by his cat in the small hours of the morning. Yes, I share that with you. His website is charlie-allison.com. Welcome, Charlie Allison.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be on here.
Yeah, no, well, that's great. Well, bless your heart, you listened to a couple of episodes, so you know how this goes. This aspires, well, it's a democratic show. You know, I'll weave context and ask questions, and you go anywhere you want, because it's aspiring to be an anarchist show, really. But there's so much richness. And we should say also that it's PM Press, may they be praised, and you have a Kickstarter now to make this book into a tangible manifest thing. Just tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Kickstarter is still up. There are about 8 days to go. It was a little surreal. The original target to hit was about 4,000, and that was met in a day. Apparently Makhno is very, very popular. Let's not kid ourselves. My illustrators are fantastic and did really great work, which can't possibly hurt, right?
No, and also just I wanted to say as I perused the PDF, but with the fabulous illustrations as well as your riveting text and stylish, wonderful expression. I have some excerpts to give people a feeling for your wonderful writing style. But I thought, if you sold prints of those drawings, I want Nestor Makhno and Kropotkin meeting at tea. That print is particularly fabulous.
I mean, I'll talk to Bonzo about it. It's one of my favorites. We went back and forth. Bonzo's a really dedicated researcher as well as an illustrator. There's one detail of the print of Makhno and Kropotkin meeting in Moscow in 1918 that we went back and forth over, and you'll never guess what it is. It's the cat by Makhno's foot. Like Makhno goes on. We could assume some things about their meeting because we only have limited notes. You couldn't get bread for love nor money, and what you could get was bad. Basically, Bonzo reached back into like Kropotkin's letters and found that he wrote a very snotty letter to someone who had mistreated his wife's cat at some point. And so said, okay, we're putting a cat in this illustration because we can't prove that there wasn't a cat in Kropotkin's Moscow apartment. So yes, the cat stays and adds a little bit of a warm atmosphere to that particular illustration.
And the drawings are, the illustrations are so fabulous and so much jollier than the grimness of the actual life, right? It's like, oh, that looks really cozy and wonderful, and there was hardly any cozy or wonderful. But for our friends and allies who don't know Nestor Makhno, well, let me just say a little bit. You have liberated me, all right, because I did have a little bit of a cartoon for which, I sent you past listener rebuked me for slandering Trotsky. But it did turn out Trotsky really did repeatedly try to assassinate Nestor Makhno. But now I'm so much more informed, and thank you. Thank you very much. But so great anarchist leader of the Ukraine, Nestor Makhno and the Makhnovists. Is there a little way you want to introduce this Well, I love that you have the coin in your desk.
Yeah, that was my sibling, as a congratulations for getting a contract with PM, sent me the state of Ukraine printed a limited run of commemorative coins of Nestor Makhno and other figures from Ukrainian history. And the sort of irony of an anarchist being on state-sponsored currency was not lost on me, but...
Right.
Yeah, it's Makhno on one side. It's a Chanka, which is a horse cart with a machine gun stapled to the back, basically, on the other side. And that's a bit of a Ukrainian proto-meme, right?
Right. Well, you do write. It takes some serious historical amnesia to put an internationalist anarchist like Makhno on a national currency as a patriot. Right. It's like a vegetarian group making a cheeseburger their logo without a dribble of self-awareness. As Volodymyr Ischenko said on the subject of modern Ukrainian nationalism, Ukrainian nationalism now mostly has right wing. Although, it's so huge. There's so many places we want to go. Do you think it's any different now, Ukrainian nationalists, or it's been obscured by the threat?
I'm not sure. We live in very interesting times, and to pull at one thread... of this, I think NPR like a week ago did a, you know, as fair a story as NPR is ever going to do about any sort of anarchists, sort of expressing amazement that anarchists are fighting on the front lines or showing solidarity against an existential threat. And there's a guy in, I think it's the Dnipro, who gets interviewed and talks about Makhno. So he's viewed very interestingly, like now that the war has been going on for more than a year, I think people are actually starting to, who aren't involved in the conflict, are starting to look up who Nestor Makhno was. And the Ukrainians are, especially in Zaporizhia or Khulyapolye, both of which are getting it rather badly at present, as I understand it, doing their best to preserve what artifacts. Written documents they can in the face of disaster. One of the really weird, although not weird in the context of practicality, but weird in as in it's unexpected, is that when the Russian invasion of Ukraine started, a lot of Ukrainian and anarchist academics uploaded and digitized as many of the archives that they would have otherwise might jealously guard and sent them to their counterparts in the West or in Europe and especially to Canada. I've made the acquaintance of Malcolm Archibald, who's the sort of tireless translator of all things Makhnovist for many years now at Black Cat Press. Another author of a book on Makhno, Sean Patterson, who wrote a truly excellent book on Makhno and his relationship with the Ukrainian Mennonites that gets into the psychology of civil war and the sort of horrors in it. I would recommend both of their works as strongly as humanly possible if you want to get deeper than I could into Makhno what he was, and he was a lot of things all at once. If I can just wrap, go ahead.
No, if you can just finish that sentence, if I can just.
Yeah, sure.
Yes, you can.
And Makhno is one of those characters who just sort of, or not characters, he's one of those historical personages who crops up in places where you don't expect him. He's got one of those faces that he never looks the same twice, but I actually found out about him through a British sci-fi and fantasy anarchist author named Michael Moorcock, who wrote an alternate history featuring Nestor Makhno. It's just this bizarre, wonderful, weirdly steam hope punk book that came out in the late 70s, The Steel Tsar. And Moorcock was nice enough to blurb this book. I believe my friend who recommended me that I approach Makhno this way said, hey, I found someone in the Russian Civil War who wasn't completely horrible. I'm like, I doubt that very much. Oh, wow, he doesn't seem that bad. Let me take a look.
Right. No, that's so great. And then we'll move to Kropotkin and many things and complexity and infighting and all of those things. And then just to say, you know, part of my gratitude is, you know, I had mentors, Kenneth and Tonya Baker. Hi there out there. Back in the 70s, before you were born, right, they introduced me and we read everything. We read everything at the time that we could find, Letters of Insurgents, an incredible novel out of Poland, and The Anarchists of Gdansk in Poland, and, you know, and Emma Goldman's autobiography, which is one of the best in the world.
Yes.
She knew everybody. She knew everybody. And as an astrologer, I love that there she was, a Cancer, in the middle of the Sun in Cancer, in the middle of the Russian Revolution, disapproving of all the sides, right? But making soup for everyone. It's like, oh, go, Emma, go, Emma. And Alexander Berkman and all of their unhappy love affairs and all the things that, you know, permeate the whole thing. But for me, already an astrologer and a mythologist and a kind of radical-leaning person, but it's like, oh, anarchism, right? It contributed to my evolving dedication to liberating Trickster, which is my primary dedication, but it did contribute to that. And then we dive into your prodigious offering, and we want, does the Kickstarter need more money, or are you good to
no,
go?
We shot over the goal a while ago. It's also, I would say its chief function right now is it's the best way to pre-order. You can always do it from PM site, but you'll get it, I think. Don't kill me, Joey, if you're listening to this. I think you'll get it faster if you order from PM, from the Kickstarter.
Right. Well, it's great because, again, it's a beautiful book. The illustrations are beautiful, and it's prodigious, and it's humming with things that we've all kind of heard about, you know, Kherson and the thing, all those plays now animated as our focus turns to Russia and Ukraine and to be educated, to be educated people. But for me at the time, and then I realized I did have slight cartoon romanticization, which you've really helped with, always the contrast between the utopian vision and then the actuality and everybody killing each other. And did you ever see the really pretty great AMC series called Turn about spies in the American Revolutionary War?
No, but I keep getting it recommended to me, and now I have to see it.
Oh, we'll do another show after you've seen it, because it's pretty great. And I did in touting it to people. It's violent, but it was violent. And I want to just come right back to that. So you know, and I would get so enthused in talking about it to people that I tricked myself into watching the whole thing again, going. But afterwards, I Googled or searched, right? Was the actual Revolutionary War as brutal and violent, you know, as depicted in Turns? Like, oh yeah, right? All war, you know, all war. Everyone on all sides do terrible things, right? I mean, that's one of your delineations, right?
Oh, absolutely. I admit that following that line was something I picked up from Sean Patterson's work, and also then reading Voline, who is one of the better writers about and in the movement. A civil war is especially brutal and unforgiving. There's no safe place. You kind of have to join a side if you. If you are not armed in a civil war, that is taken badly by everyone. And if you are armed, it's assumed that you're sympathetic to the other side, and so violence happens. It tends to escalate violence to levels that are unmanageable and really kind of unimaginable in the global north at a systemic level now. But
and almost always the betrayal of the vision.
Oh yeah,
and I think it's so useful to go Revolutionary War. People very brutal on every possible side, and in a sense, kind of like your book, imminently available. Turn does a good job because you do go, what would I have done? What would I have done? You know, with so much danger, you know, and would I have been a spy? Would I have been, you know, Nestor Makhno? Well, only Nestor Makhno could be Nestor Makhno with, you know, so much prison and typhoid and tuberculosis and escaping and his wife giving birth in prison and then escaping and then in prison again. And then it just, it's like, wow. But dedicated, but...
Absolutely. There's an interesting thread I wanted to pull at. I was raised with a pretty heavy Quaker background. I seem to remember the Quakers were persecuted by literally everyone in every war that America ever fought on its own soil, because they were pacifists. And, you know, if you're a military, you are distrustful of pacifists. So you have this sort of relic of the English Civil War still living through a revolution. The question of pacifism actually comes up in Makhno's homeland, where there were a lot of Ukrainian Mennonites who are a pacifist religion. And so there's this deep split. And again, I'm going to keep plugging Sean Patterson's work because he does a great job. The Mennonites were split between true pacifists who would not pick up a gun against the White Army or the Bolsheviks or the Black Army or any of the sort of marauding gangs, and those who did take, say, Austro-Hungarian arms and training and form self-defense squads, and that got them excoriated by their co-religionists saying, oh, so you're just a pacifist when things are good, in effect. It's a heart-wrenching scenario I wouldn't wish on anyone to watch your principles be a object of agony for you. And there's a lot going on there. Sorry, there's a bit of a tangent, but there's a bit of a connector there, I guess. I don't know.
No, tangents are our friends. That's good. But it's also when you say that Nestor Makhno, you know, he read Kropotkin's Mutual Aid, kept a copy with him at all times. I love the engraving of the meeting at tea with the cat. And then, you know, Kropotkin approves of World War I. And I think you write that, I recall that the war broke out in 1914, 3 years into one of Makhno's many jail sentences. Mm-hmm. And Kropotkin's logic was that while the war was awful and shouldn't be happening, it was happening. And the Allied powers were at least preferable to the overt authoritarianism of the Central Powers. To support them would be to help governments in Europe and indeed worldwide roll back what few freedoms had been won over the last 50 years, harm reduction in essence. And supporting the war in any regard was not a popular position among anarchists the world over. In this regard, Makhno was no exception. But you say, Makhno takes pains to point out in his memoirs that while he strongly disagreed with Kropotkin's stance on the war, he did not respect him or his hard work any less for it. Right. Complex.
Yeah. It was a big topic of discussion, especially in Russian prisons, where a lot of the anarchists tended to end up. This didn't happen where Makhno was serving his life sentence, but they talked about it. Where the czarist regime was like, well, what if we offer you amnesty if you go to the front with a gun? And this provoked, and you know, you've read that chapter, a lot of discussion among the inmates about would you take a pardon and go and fight for the empire? And you know, some of the social democrats and nationalists said, yeah, sign me up. And nothing came from it in that case, but it's a pretty stark dividing line for Kropotkin, especially, who. I keep finding it wild that he lived as long as he did to 1921, like who's watched all the 19th century, the big 19th century revolutions unfold, that this has to look so different than it would for a younger man like Makhno. But yeah, there's room for comrades to disagree, especially if you can't really do much about the event, right?
Right. Well, that's why I bring it up, going, the thing is, you know, I disapprove of it, but it's happening, and what are we going to do? Well, it's the teasing of the vision into what are we going to do. you know, and what's the best possible thing, and to have a kind of respect. I mean, the connection between Quaker and anarchism, I found, and you can guide me into or out of this thing, but mm-hmm. my understandings, or the way I grappled with my early in the 70s studying anarchism, was that it was the only, you know, kind of political philosophy and action of community that had some cooperate with everything magic to it. Mm-hmm. And that sense, kind of like, I don't know Quaker well, but I was in a Quaker work camp and I've been to Quaker things. That idea of each person tapping into their own deep, authentic self, and then from that, community accord would come. Is that a fair thought about Quakerism and the ideal form of anarchism?
Yeah. I think that is an excellent descriptor of both those things. The Quakers really tend to practice what they preach about the nonviolence, obviously, but also the way they structure both their religion and their communities really did, as much as was practicable, go into the horizontal structures as opposed to top-down things. Which, you know, breeds a sort of cosmopolitanness, I guess.
And if only Nestor Makhno had been able to attend Quaker meeting, he might have found some momentary peace.
And also
Quaker's not big on drinking. Nope. You know, through the book and through life and through left wing everything, this and that, it's like and the history especially, but there's quite a lot of alcohol and guns, and you wonder, well, how would it have been better if it had been fueled on ganja? Fantastic novel by Perry Henzel on Power Game, where the Jamaican Revolution is fueled on ganja, and it's completely anarchist in a wonderful way.
Sounds amazing.
Oh, different. Well, it's a great book. It's a fabulous book. I highly recommend it. Perry Henzel, great Jamaican writer. But yeah, so there's all that. And then just to stay with Kropotkin and then go forwards and backwards and wherever you want to go.
Sure.
But you say Makhno was physically struck by Kropotkin's arguments, and he carried a copy of Mutual Aid with him wherever he could. And maybe we will too, in hopes of discussing it with whomever else had read it. The new world could be built now by organizing autonomous communes and liberating the oppressed more than by shooting the police dead in the street. Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
And then I was just going to go to his funeral. To make a dark picture darker still, in February 1921, Kropotkin, anarchist luminary and one of Makhno's inspirations, died in Moscow of pneumonia. Yeah, it was hard living there. I mean, the typhoid, the typhoid epidemic that took out 2 to 4 million people, you know, mm-hmm. here or there, you know,
yeah.
2 or 4 million either way. Makhno died of tuberculosis, right? So there's, yep, Kropotkin dying of pneumonia. His last letters to Lenin were ignored as he argued with the Bolshevik leader that authoritarianism couldn't bring social revolution. Kropotkin witnessed the starving citizens of Moscow firsthand and relayed their desperate plight to a typically indifferent Lenin. I love your writing. All Lenin had done, Kropotkin concluded bitingly, was show how a revolution was not to be conducted, that is, along authoritarian right-wing lines. You know, and it goes on. The old saint without a god of anarchism mourned, yeah, the lost potential of the revolution in Russia and would have left for France in the spring of 1920 if he could have. Yeah, and then, well, it goes on. I mean, I'm surrounded by by sticky notes and cards and things and excerpts from your book and spicy writing. But go wherever you want to.
Oh, right? You're very kind to say all these things.
But, well, it's worthy, and it's so organized, and also just for the fun of it too, there are some things that I so loved, and I want to communicate to our dedicated listeners who care about history and politics and what are we going to do now, that your writing style is very fun. Can I read your takedown of Voltaire?
Oh, please do. I love being sassy at Voltaire, especially because he's dead, yes, and can't respond.
No, it's really good. Okay, so, I mean, I have it here because I highlighted it. Voltaire, who was flitting about the court of Catherine the Great like some incredibly verbally ornate butterfly, suggested asking the distraught and exhaustive Pugachev, "Sir, are you master or servant?" "I do not ask who employs you, but simply whether you are employed." Voltaire lingered under the impression that other people thought he was funny. Oh, Charlie. Right. He was so hilarious that he had to flee the court of Frederick the Great after he made one side splitter too many. I like your style. I like your style. It's very just so because, you know, it's like making light of darkness. You're in very deep material, and but we want the right. And it's not, you know, as I you know, commented backstage on your Twitter handle and everything, it's you're not snarky or sarcastic, but you are ironic. And I find irony liberating. So there.
Why thank you. I mean that's yeah. very kind of you to say. The context for Voltaire showing up in a book about Machno is
yes.
I sort of wanted to ground the sort of Machnovist and general peasant uprisings and dissatisfaction with centralized authority in historical precedent. So I talked about the last great peasant uprising led by a guy named Emelian Pugachev, who is actually, if you ever see the sort of historical fiction mockumentary The Great, I think it's on HBO or something, it's Dakota Fanning is Catherine the Great. It's not even close to historical, but it is very funny. He shows up there. Anyway, he claims to be Catherine the Great's very dead, but also very popular husband, the Tsar. He did such fun things like abolish the secret police and give some sort of land reform, and then Catherine the Great rolls that back. But Emelian Pugachev leads this huge uprising that comes very close to overthrowing the centralized power of the Russian Empire, only to fall at the last minute, which really informs how like revolutionary struggle is framed in Ukrainian culture and in the Ukraine that Machno grew up in, right? Like there are cartoons, I forgot to put it in the book because that sort of show like a cartoon Emelian Pugachev throwing bombs at the Kremlin during the Russian Civil War saying, you know, here's your bread, you know, because the Bolshevik requisition squads were starving people even in the middle of the Civil War. So there's this wonderful deep well even before Machno comes onto the scene. But what Machno understood but then couldn't put into practice like a good anarchist is that your means have to match your ends, right? If you use authoritarian means like the Bolsheviks did, the outcome will be an authoritarian structure. But if you use democratic, liberatory means to achieve your ends, whether that be justice, food, housing, or even building community, then the outcome will be democratic, egalitarian, and, you know, with a little bit of luck, anarchist. Right. Sorry, that was a small tangent there.
No, we like the
I know, this is the tangent friendly space, and I love it.
Oh yeah, no, completely. It's a spiral. That's right. We don't want to have an impact. Boom. We want an influence, which is spirally and tributaries going here and there. So we're going to take a very very short musical break in some moments. But our splendid guest Charlie Allison has written, and it is now available to lucky people. You can see it on the web posting on KPFA and at coyotenetworknews.com. Of his super, super useful and beautifully illustrated, and we'll come back to the title when we're on the other side, No Harmless Power, The Life and Times of the Ukrainian Anarchist Nestor Makhno. It's so useful, and I found in the book, you say, as Makhno wrote in the ABCs of the Revolutionary Anarchist, there is no such thing as harmless power. I go, okay. And we'll be right back after this very short break.
She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled him across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Ooh, chiny, 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 come blow my chiny home. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and you can find all of our radio postings at kpfa.org, Visionary Activist Show, or at coyotenetworknews.com, where you can read more about our great guest, Charles Allison. So, yeah, well, there's so many places we want to go, but always that model of, you know, the discrepancy between utopian theory, vision, and then actuality. And and then the infighting, which is a pertinent thing among all progressive realms. I like to invoke Alison Lurie's quote: "The reason academic politics is so vicious is because the stakes are so small." It's like, oh, get them right, because there's all this kind of no. It's more the stakes are actually higher, you know, in what you're writing about, you know, like death and freedom and everything, but still that idea of like going the turning on each other. And did you ever subscribe to the Fifth Estate? Do you know what that is?
Yes, I do know what that is. We carry it in the info shop I volunteer at. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and I did just take a little look, and it's like they're still going, by God.
Oh yeah,
non-state.
Doesn't seem to be any stopping them.
No, I love it. It's five. I don't know if it's still $5 a year, but it was very, very smart. But then even back then in the 70s, before you were born, it would then break out into infighting, like, you know, some small theoretical thing. But what I wanted to bring back, and I think that your book, No Harmless Power, contributes to is, you know, and from Emma Goldman, you know, she really brings alive that in this country and all over the world, in small cities and villages and whatever, there were, you know, ardent public discussions about, you know, political philosophy and how it should be, among, you know, working class, going, just, you know, smart and working it out, and sometimes degrading into, you know, viciousness, you know, but a real lively, you know, informed to and fro discourse. Really, you know, I guess twenties and thirties in this country, but the anarchists were always getting locked up and everything, right? So, Nowhere at Home, I guess, is one of the titles of Emma Goldman's autobiography. Tough that way, but yeah. So, I mean, do you feel that maybe, you know, you're in a sense contributing to, like, let's talk about these things, right? About how we should structure society.
I mean, I would on my best day. That's what I allow myself to hope. There's always a wonderful tension when you get into anarchist theory and restructuring. And to bring us back to Goldman briefly, I think, if I'm remembering the quote properly, one of the things that frustrated her most was just the what she called the denial, right? The average person's just denial of the idea of anarchism's promise of liberation and equality and more leisure time. And who could say no to that and not being bossed around? And it's, she says something along the lines of, like, I just hit a wall and I don't know how to talk to these people. They just assume there must be some sort of authority over them. I think this is after the Russian Revolution. But I'm not sure if
Well, you speak about, you know, one of Nestor Makhno's first mentors, Voldemar Antoni.
Antoni,
the last night grunt. Thank you. Cleansing my mind of the slightest trace of slave mentality and cleansing it of the desire to submit to any authority. And we go, well, that's pretty good.
It is really good.
You know, anarchos simply means without leader, and we see this in nature all over the place. And the more we know, the more so much of what we humans had presumed and out of speciesism projected onto other animals is like not true. And then I just wanted to bring up two examples, because biomimicry and I think regenerative farming might be the anarchist direction. And then we can talk about how anarchists got kind of a bad name by being hoovered up by people dressed in black with trust funds who just wanted to break windows. All right, there's that on the side there. But really, I love there was a documentary, a particular kind of deer in Africa, and it was, you know, all female deer and one guy. And they're like, well, the one guy clearly makes the decisions, right, like when to go for water. And what they watched is going when you go for water is important to the herd because you don't want to get dehydrated, but you don't want to go when predators are there. And what they observed was one deer would hold up its head and point to the water, and then another deer and another deer. And when the majority were pointing, they all went, right? And the guy had nothing to do with it, right? The guy was a sperm donor. That was it. It was democratic. And then, you know, wonderful Janine Benyus, whom I also view as contributing to the absolute sine qua non of how to go, you know, humans humbly cooperating, mutual aid with nature's, you know, guiding genius. And she, long ago when I interviewed her, said, do you know how bees practice democracy? I'm like, oh, no, tell me. And she said, well, when they need to move, when the community needs to move, they send out scout bees, all separately going out, and all the scout bees come back and they dance the place that they saw. And the bees, you know, observing these dance performances of place, of possible place relocation, they go hang out with the bee whose dance they like best. And when there's a majority, that's where they all go. Isn't that wonderful?
That is wonderful. You're mentioning bees makes me think of a really there's a great short story by E. Lily Yu called "The Cartographer Wasps and the Anarchist Bees" that was nominated for the Hugo, I think in 2012, and it's about this, and it becomes a political parable very quickly, but it's beautiful writing. E. Lily Yu. And the short story is "The Cartographer Wasps and the Anarchist Bees." Yes, definitely worth reading. I think Neil Gaiman scooped it up and put it in his collection of short stories about fabulous creatures or something that was printed in like 2016 or something. But yes, sorry, you mentioned bees, and that's where my brain went.
No, that's good. No, you're welcome to unfurl and wherever you want to go. That's really great. No, I like it. It's an unfurling. The tangent is the river. Because it brings back to a theme that resonates throughout your book. No harmless power, Life and Times of the Ukrainian Anarchist Nestor Makhno, of no hero. Right. Remember, it's in Brecht's play on Galileo, a sort of follower of Galileo's go, no, do it. Sacrifice yourself. Be a martyr. You know, be a hero. You know, happy is the country that has its hero. And the Galileo character says, you know, happier still is the country that needs no hero.
That's a great line. I wish I'd known about it when I was writing the book.
There'll be others, and we look forward to your course or your gathering or your mutual aid, whatever, because the book is so rich. It's like, yeah, and we want to have conversations and go, wow. So stick that somewhere. But yes, that's right. But so there's a lot of that too about the problem of being a hero, and you know, Nestor Makhno, you know, befoibled and
I love conjugation. It's so good. Sorry, go ahead. Befoibled. I've never heard it before.
I use it frequently. You know, truly we are all befoibled. It's a good way to engage. Yeah, absolutely. Let's spread it like a meme. I've had this, they do go forth, and you know, we sort of like attribution, but really the word is more important. And I do think, you know, my trickster council, we've been brewing atmospheric mist that we imaginatively fill with, you know, herbs like devil's claw and lavender and psilocybe mushrooms. And we wafted out that anything up to no good fizzle like a wet firecracker fart. And it seems quite effective. But on Twitter the other day, I saw some important news guy, like with 500,000 followers, going, "And I hope that fizzles like a wet firecracker fart." And I'm like, "I coined that. I coined that. But happy for you to use it." Okay, there you go. You know, as the magic prevails through the words. So, yeah. So, no heroes. No heroes. Right. And that's why Kropotkin was a saint without a god. You know, mm-hmm. So we love that. And then, you know, there was certainly not enough joy, right? And you know, and it's Emma's sort of famous thing. I don't know if she really said it. You know, if you want me to join your revolution, there must be more dancing. You know, maybe. But the point's well taken in that you leaven your book with, you know, like, what do you see when you hear the word volia? Right, and you, and who is Teffy? It's a long quote from Teffy.
Teffy was a wonderful Russian essayist, journalist, and author. She's one of my favorite ancillary sources on the period. She knew everyone. She's like the sort of maybe not anti Emma Goldman, but like different social class, different views, all this. But she like. She got weird, dirty notes from Rasputin. She knew Lenin before his exile, where he tried to take over the newspaper she was working at and just made it unreadable. And so she skewers him in his writing, and then is actually in Odessa in 1918 and on sort of the last boat out of Ukraine as the Allies sort of stop funding that iteration of the White Army. But her writings in exile are – even in English translation, I'm sure they have even more power in the original Russian, are just beautiful. And that sort of excerpt about Volia seemed like a good thing to put in as the heading for the right. chapter where Makhno gets out of prison.
Yeah, well, can I read it? Is that okay?
Oh, please, absolutely, go for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is from Teffy, who was just introduced to us by Charles Allison, whose book, No Harmless Power, is rich, historical, fabulous, no hero, context, complexity, and spicy writing style. But here's Teffy. What do you see when you hear the word volia? An unbroken freedom or will, an unbroken horizon, someone striding along, sure-footed, but not thinking about tracks or paths, not going anywhere in particular. There's a fabulous word that I've been spreading around, coddywomple, and it means to travel purposely to a destination as yet unknown. And that's very Teffy here. But so not going any bareheaded. The wind ruffles hair and blows over eyes, since for his kind every wind is a tailwind. A bird flies by spreading its wings wide, and this man waves both arms high in the air and calls out to the bird in a wild voice, then bursts into laughter. Freedom is a matter of law. Volia takes no account of anything. Freedom is an individual's civil status. Volia is a feeling. That's great.
Yeah, right?
It's really... Yeah. Well, because you're offering all of this, that we want to tease it into pertinence. You know, again, it's the history is crucial, you know, and to know what's been passed as a beginning, you know, really going, oh, that's really important. But then... to go, you know, where did it get, you know, infighty and authoritarian and absolutely that, you know, over and over the people that you love and that you've brought alive to us, you know, are like you can't have an authoritarian revolution bring forth a democratic anarchist or community. And, you know, anarchist has such a bad name now, you know, but I, again, for me, it's like, It is the Kropotkin realm, you know. It is Kropotkin's making a, you know, he's quoted in almost every environmental book coming out right now. Kropotkin, right? That's why I'm wondering if the welcome shifting maybe from political diatribe like is into the realm of like planting and farms and how do we how and community and what is it to be a good citizen, and let's all define that for ourselves. And you know, I'd written to you going, you know, I have Nestor's birthday, you know, and you know, what is yours? But it turns out, as you start off one chapter, Nestor Makhno was so poor he didn't even have a birthday, right? So we don't really know when he was born.
Yeah. He wasn't ever completely sure of his birthday. He might have believed it was one thing, but it was actually another.
Right. But I'm fond of November 7th, 1888. In his town near Zaporizhia, you know, and just well, we can do a whole other show on mythology and everything too. There's going to be a lot of outtakes for this show. But then just for the fun of it, because I like surprising playful guests. But you know, your own chart, which we won't expose secrets or anything because there are none. but there are metaphors for each degree of the zodiac, and I love the metaphor for your sun when you were born. That degree, 16 Pisces, is rich and poor alike pour out onto rain-drenched streets in a joyous rebirth celebration. Isn't that kind of fun for you?
Gorgeous. I love the words, and I like even more what it implies.
Yeah. Pope Francis has some planet there too. You and Pope Francis, the differences can be worked out. I love that. And then just for the fun of it, your sun squares Uranus. So you are a, you know, rebellious, ingenious person, of course. And the image for your Uranus is the torch and crown of the Statue of Liberty, the necessity to defend freedom from tyranny. That's very you.
I mean, I'm not going to say it's not. That's
and then just for the fun of it, it's right next to Mars in 19 Sagittarius, which astrologers call the global climate resolving degree, because it's about long-term cyclical vision to work things out. So there you are, lad.
Mm.
Oh, wait, there's one more thing. I can't help myself.
Yeah.
Because we love symmetry. So today, right now, the sun is at 7 degrees of Cancer, whose image is rabbits parade disguised as humans. So it's like we're not contained by speciesism. We're just whatever we love, we've taken on a human form to protect it. And it exactly trines Saturn at 7 degrees Pisces, which is humans picking up a bugle to call in a new tide of cultural energy. And we go, that's great. And it forms a grand trine to your Pluto at 7 Scorpio. I just had to bring that up going, 7, 7, 7, Charles Allison, it's truly kismet. You were meant to be here today. That's really great. And then just for the fun of it, because I did read pretty much every word, but some I skimmed, you know, in your prodigious book, but I'll go back over it. Oh, thank you. That's good. But there's some things, you know. So Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman, you know, remarkable humans, full of befoibelment and bickering and complexity. But you say, you know, and they went to Kropotkin's funeral. Boy, that would have been a great funeral to go to. But you say that, you know, then they were sort of, you know, not supporters, but colleagues of Makhno's, but they did critique Makhno's platform.
Yep.
Is there a simple way you could bring that critique into our play
here? Yes. Platform, as I understand it, and as the anarchists in Paris after the Russian Civil War ended understood it, was an attempt by Makhno and Arshinov, and it got named the Arshinov platform. Didn't put Makhno's name on it. And it was an attempt to answer the question of, hey, why did we lose the Civil War and the Revolution when anarchism proved very popular and, you know, we had them on the ropes, but why did we lose in the end? And Makhno and Arshinov's answer to that question was, hey, we got out organized by the Bolsheviks, so we got to take some. They would never phrase it this way, but we have to, you know, take some tips and tricks from the Bolsheviks, and we have to have a central committee, and we have to have standard lines for recruitment and propaganda, and we have to, you know, centralize a bit, which the other anarchists, and I think Molly Steimer, R.I.P. Molly Steimer, one of my favorite anarchists who doesn't get enough cred, said, listen, the platform's biggest error, I'm paraphrasing, is that it assumes that the people must be politically led. And once you go there, it's not much further until you have a Cheka. And these are people who, you know, survived being hunted by the secret police. So
right.
The platform in 1920s, early 30s Paris is very different from platformist anarchism now. Partly because, you know, Soviet Union's not really a thing anymore. But it was greatly hindered by Makhno's, you know, sort of confrontational personality.
And spinning a gun during meetings all the time.
Oh God, yeah, no, like he's not A plus gun safety, Nestor Makhno. But the reason that the platform died and only recently became a force in like modern anarchism now, after like a 50-70 year hiatus, is that Arshinov, one of the co-drafters of it, and like a former Makhnovist, repatriated back to the Soviet Union in 1933 to take a job in Stalin's government, which seemed to confirm every bad thing the world anarchist scene had said about the platform, right? That it's just Bolshevized anarchism, right? Well, if one of your two founders goes back to Stalin, there's almost no way a movement can recover from that in that lifetime. But platformist anarchism now, as I understand it, is very different. There's a huge South American influence. There's a concept called especifismo that I am not well versed in, but it seems to be a personal version of prefiguration and working within existing left struggles and being a role model as an anarchist and getting influence and spreading the cause that way, rather than having a centralized central committee with standard lines on propaganda. If you want to learn more about it, there's a YouTuber called Anarch, A-N-A-R-K, who did a really good breakdown of the modern platform and is generally a really good – I hate this phrase. But he's a very good content creator, but he's a very – skilled video essayist on anarchism and democratic means. So I'd recommend that if you're looking into it.
Right. No, you go.
I was going to say to touch on the no heroes thing that we brought up a minute ago. There's a sort of, I think there's a quote from Alfredo and Bonanno that I use, which is that at a certain point, heroism becomes a the word he uses is a prosthetic, right? It becomes something that you use to get through life that you wouldn't otherwise use. Like, and then he sort of mixes metaphors a bit, but it's like alcohol or sleeping pills. You need someone to be a hero to excuse you not doing the things you would like to do that your conscience would demand you do.
No, this is crucial because, you know, in the kind of astro mythology, you know, it's like Saturn represents our authority, our capacity to all define things for ourselves. And so it's the one part of ourselves we all tend most to outsource to leaders. And that's the part of the tricky dynamic, which is, you know, and part of the hero thing is, do we outsource our authority to another? And it's like, oh, we're already in trouble here. You know,
yeah, exactly.
And
that's a really great way of putting it.
Right. So we want to, and you know, how I'm kind of working with self and kind of anarcho-astrology team is, you know, for all of us who aspire, it's a daily practice because we do it all day long. Anytime we feel fear, we've outsourced our authority to the dental bill, you know. It's like, no, inhale that back in there. So it is you know, part of our useful conversation. So for all of us who insource authority, we are sucking the chi out of authoritarianism externally, right? And it's, you know, part of being a good citizen. But I just wanted to bring up also You know, Brecht has a great essay on five obstacles to telling the truth, and I, of course, like to turn it into five opportunities to tell the truth. But he says the primary obstacle is when good-hearted, progressive people tell this story. We are good, we come up against evil, we are smushed, but we are good. And he said we got to quit telling that story about how the good is weak, as water is wet. You know, and I think that's part of the dynamic. And then I just wanted to kind of proffer it to you, and then toss it back to you in the all too short waning time. But I think we should carry this on somewhere. So for me, it's like, okay, anarcho, and then I just want to add entheo anarchism, right? Wouldn't it have been more fun to, you know, hang out with Nestor Makhno and Emma and Alexander Berkman on mushrooms?
Oh my God, I'm trying to so hard to imagine like Makhno, who's a bit uptight at the best of times, trying to unwind.
Yes, but I want to see him dancing with mushrooms. I think, well, that's what we have now to lighten the political heart into ecstatic kinship with nature and joy and dancing as part of the thing, while maintaining all of the wonderful guiding principles. But we are. We're so speedily on our. Oh, I just have to say also, I'm dusting off all my old books, including you reference the great book about Japan, The Nobility of Failure. I'm like, God, I have it right here.
Yes,
and somebody noticed it years ago and go, good bedtime reading, is it, The Nobility of Failure? But that's, you know, back to better a trickster than a martyr. I give you the last word. We're on our way out in 1 minute if there's anything you want to say, but thank you so much.
Absolutely. I would say that to pick up with the previous thread about Kropotkin and growing things, that the most anarchist thing you can do is start something at a local democratic level, whether it's a community garden or a squat or contributing to bail funds or whatever. It is insourcing authority and refusing to let someone else do it for you at some basic level, and rejecting the sort of trap of heroism, if we can paraphrase Ivan Morris's prologue to The Nobility of Failure, which was a huge influence from my old mentor, Doug Stifler, who I hope is listening.
Oh, that's so great. That's so great. Well, thank you so much, Charlie Allison. His book, No Harmless Power, The Life and Times of the Ukrainian Anarchist Nestor Makhno. You can find the links at kpfa.org or coyotenetworknews.com. And I'm surrounded by notes that we haven't even, notes on your prodigious work that we haven't even gotten to, but everything leads to so many things. Thank you again.
Thank you again for having me on. Keep up
that's
the
great.
Excellent
and thanks
work.
Always to... Oh, that's great. And thanks always to Kirsten Thomas. I'm Caroline Casey. We will reconvene next week. Happy full moon. Woof.
Ehrenreich.
And I can't resist, you know, teaching a little bit of biology here. That's what I studied in school. Do you know that 80% of the fertilized eggs that occur through the process of conception don't make it anyway? They get washed away in the monthly flow. They never get on to implant and become a real pregnancy. So, mightn't it be a good idea to save those used tampons? Because who knows what great kids might be living on them. And send them to the Supreme Court.
Storytelling for Social Change on KPFA.
KPFA's local station board election is here, and we invite you to participate. In order to vote and run as a candidate, you must be a current member by making a minimum donation of $25 between July 1st, 2022 and June 30th, 2023. If your membership has lapsed, go to kpfa.org/donate to become a member today. Make sure to give your email at the time of renewal, as this is where you will receive your e-ballot. Visit elections.pacifica.org for the voter guide, candidate nomination package, and nominator registration. Candidate Nomination packets must be completed by June 30th. Contact the election supervisor by emailing NES@Pacifica.org or leaving a voicemail on 213-635-9363. It's 94.1 KPFA, 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at KPFA.org.